KPCC's podcasts are supported by Harvey Mudd College, where engineering, science, and mathematics are informed by the liberal arts. Students and faculty working together to solve problems and serve society. Online at hmc.edu.
I'm Pat Morrison. You probably breathed a sigh of relief after 78 days when we finally had a budget. It wasn't an oil painting, as your great aunt might say, but at least it was done, and they straggled over the finish line with it and then sent it to the governor, who, as it turns out, said he would veto it. We'll talk about the implications of that with the Assembly Speaker Karen Bass in a few moments, but Dan Weintraub is the editorial columnist at the Sacramento Bee and author of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Party of One. Dan, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So the legislature has a two-thirds vote to override the veto. They had to get two-thirds to pass this budget in the first place, but now it seems like the face-to-face between the governor and the legislature's backing away?
Well, they're not quite backing away yet. They're actually threatening to override him if he goes ahead with the veto, but they're still...
I've been reading alarmist literature.
They're still deep in discussions, and I think what they're trying to do is maybe just tweak one little piece of the package that the governor is most upset about, and hope that that he will calm down if they give him part of what he's looking for on that issue, and that involves the creation of a new rainy day fund for the state.
So this could all end with cigars and not explosions?
Or maybe exploding cigars. It's too soon to tell. I think we'll know within a few hours exactly how that's going to play out. If he does veto the budget, it's likely to be tomorrow. And if he does go ahead and do that, I don't think there's much doubt that the legislature will override his veto.
Well, at 11:30 this morning, the Big Five met, the leaders of both houses of the legislature, along with the governor. Karen Bass is the numero uno among the Big Five at the legislative table, certainly. She's the Speaker of the Assembly and a Democrat from Los Angeles. Speaker Bass, what happened at that meeting?
Well, actually, negotiations are continuing. I believe we're going to get together in another hour or so. And what we would like to do, we would like to avoid a veto, and we would like to avoid a veto override. I have no doubt that if the governor vetoes the bill, that we will override it. But, you know, I mean, if there's an opportunity to reach peace before then, we would certainly like to do that. I am just so concerned about all of the pain and suffering that 80 days without a budget has caused.
And so we still have public agencies, we still have halfway houses and women's shelters and health clinics that aren't getting their checks still because this is still held up?
That's absolutely right. And Pat, you know, I used to run a community-based program, and I know what it means to go through this. And individuals are being hurt who receive direct services. And, you know, I think this is just so unfortunate. And so you have the governor who has put forward his budget, and I'm going back a couple of weeks, and the problem is that he has been unable to get one Republican vote for his budget. We're in agreement with him. We know we need to raise revenue. The problem is that he can't get his folks in his own party to go along with that. So I really think it's time, once this is done, and I really hope it's done within the next couple of days, either in a veto override or in a tweaking of a deal, as the last guest said, that we really look at the whole two-thirds ballot initiative, because people really have to realize that California needs to be like 47 other states, not Arkansas and Rhode Island.
The governor has said that that's something he doesn't want to change.
Well, he might not want to change it, but that's exactly why we're in this situation we're in right now. And, you know, typically in the past, governors have been able to secure votes. It's not so in this case, but we know that next year we'll be in the same position. We know we're going to need revenue next year.
Well, did you see anything in the 11:30 meeting today to make you think that there are Republicans who are willing to go over to the governor's side on this?
Well, I think that there is room for a compromise, and that's what I'm hoping will happen before the day is over, but we're not there yet. And I will tell you, though, one of my frustrations over the last few months is that there have been many times, and I've been on your show many times, when I've told you that we were near a compromise, and for whatever reason, the plane never completely lands. It takes off again.
Now, the governor got 2 out of 3 of the budget reforms that he wanted.
Exactly.
In this budget. So nobody got everything in this budget. Why should he?
Well,
Is that the message?
That was certainly our message the other day. And so, you know, we will see what happens with that. Yesterday we did go in and say, okay, if we gave you the other one, would that be enough? And, you know, he wants to look at other parts of the budget. And so, you know, that's, again, the frustration that I explained. We get very close to a compromise, and then the plane takes off again.
So at this point, are the leaders of the legislature and the governor really amenable to sitting on this for a few more days and trying to feel this out and see what might happen? Or is there impatience?
I actually think a few more days might be too long. I really think that, you know, if something is going to happen one way or another, either a veto or a deal, it's going to happen within the next 24 hours. He is scheduled to veto the bill tomorrow. So if a deal is not reached today, then it would be vetoed tomorrow. And then we would override immediately after.
And is this the only point on which the governor is so insistent?
Well, no. Actually, there are a couple of others, but, you know, we're dealing with that in private negotiations.
So you can't reveal what
right.
else it is that might be on the table. Are these immensely substantive matters, or are these fairly... Well, I won't use the word negligible, but less than earth-shaking.
Well, I think they're less than earth-shaking.
And
so there is the potential, and so we will be getting back together in a couple of hours, and I am hoping that we will reach a conclusion one way or another.
So if it comes to a veto override, the budget is adopted. Through the override, the checks start going back out. Where does that leave the relationship between the legislature and the governor?
Well, I think that it'll be a little tense for a while. But, you know, even in these negotiations, even when we have been, you know, in the midst of deep disagreements, they've never been hostile. I mean, you know, we can look at each other in the eye. We can work together and say, you know, I can't go there. My Republican colleagues who say I cannot vote for taxes. And, you know, somehow I think we believe that it was about a pledge. And I really don't think it's about a pledge at all. I think it's about term limits because, you know, we only have 6 years to serve in the legislature. Especially the Republicans in my house are young. They're in their 30s and their 40s. They're in the beginning or the middle of their political career. They feel if they vote for taxes that they can't run in a Republican primary again because of the dogmatic position that the Republican Party has taken in the state of California.
So I don't suppose there's any stepping down from that position that they took.
See, that's exactly why I say we have to look at two-thirds. I mean, to me, that's the lesson that we learned this year, to think that we're going to come back in 6 months and they're going to change their mind. From their point of view, if they hit the button for taxes, they have given up their political career. It is a side effect of term limits. Because people are here for such a short period of time, the average assembly member is thinking about what they're going to run for next.
Now, Tom McClintock, who is notoriously pinch-penny about public dollars, is going to Congress where there are no term limits, and he said maybe it's time to revisit this two-thirds. Do you think that Republicans would be secretly relieved, but Democrats may be secretly alarmed if the budget threshold changes, and if they vote for taxes, voters are going to hold them accountable?
Well, here's what the Republicans say, and I don't know about McClintock because he is in a world of his own. They say a majority vote for the budget, but two-thirds vote to raise revenues. And so that kind of locks us in the same situation. Now, what I really believe should happen as soon as we resolve this budget mess is we need to study the whole situation. And I mean through polling, through focus groups. We really need to see what makes the best sense. We need to look back in history and look at the budgets that, you know, have been voted on, and we need to see, do we put something on the ballot that says majority vote no matter what? Do we say majority vote and 55% for taxes? Do we say majority vote and two-thirds? There's several different versions that we need to look at.
Karen Bass is the Speaker of the Assembly, a Los Angeles Democrat. We tried to get someone from the Republican side, but they're busy. They're in meetings, and there's another meeting of the Big Five in a couple of hours. Speaker Bass, I hope you'll come back and let us know what happens.
Thank you. I certainly will. Bye-bye.
Dan Weintraub with the Sacramento Bee and author of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Party of One, it does sound like loggerheads, but here we have the governor who was about to be steamrollered by this budget he didn't like, who's providing some pushback.
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's one of his better moments as governor. I mean, he's been caving in to the legislature for 5 years now, and all it's got him is a $17 billion budget deficit.
And his 30% plan, approval rating.
Yeah, his plan is not perfect by any means. It's not even great. But the plan that the legislature put together is one of the worst budgets of all time, if not the worst. And it deserves to be vetoed. And if all that happens is you get an override, I think Schwarzenegger goes into next year with the high ground here. He can say, okay, you guys did what you wanted, and look at the disaster you created. Now let's try it my way.
So the sticking point seemed to be the rainy day fund, as well as a couple other things that Speaker Bass alluded to that she wouldn't detail. What do you suppose those things are that the governor wants?
I think one of them is this plan that they put out to force taxpayers to essentially give interest-free loans to the state by paying more than they're required to pay in taxes and then getting refunds later. It's a crazy, backwards way of raising money, and it doesn't even raise it permanently. It just makes no sense. Apparently first hatched by the governor's own Department of Finance, but he never put his name on it, and the legislature loved the idea and ran with it. Now he's opposing it. But either wherever the idea came from, it's crazy and shouldn't be part of any budget deal, and I think he's trying to get them to come up with something else rather than that.
Was there something else, another point you think that he's pursuing?
I think that's the main one, that and the rainy day fund. And it's not a little point. You said he got 2 out of 3, but the 2 were kind of meaningless, and the 3rd is everything. It's what prevents the legislature from drawing down the reserve for any purpose. He wants them to only be able to use the rainy day fund when it's truly raining, when we're in a recession and revenues fall short. The legislature would like to be able to just pull out the money anytime they want, which makes the whole point of a rainy day fund moot.
Dan, do you think that the governor will come out of this with any better relationship with the Republicans in the legislature?
Hardly. I think it's getting worse by the day. As my book suggested, party of one, he's never been more of a party of one than he is right now. But the legislature's dysfunctional, and the Republican caucuses in the legislature are at odds, I think, even with many of the Republican voters in this state. So if I were the governor, I wouldn't be terribly embarrassed or worried about not being in sync with them. It'd be nice if he could bring them around to some kind of sensible middle ground, but I'm not sure anybody could do that.
The last quick point from Bruce on the KPCC blog was, why do we need to play these games in the most powerful state in the union? How is the impasse helping those most in need? Where's the disconnect between the legislature and what actually needs to be done for people who are affected by this budget?
The disconnect is that California has a lot of mainstream, independent-minded voters, but its legislature is in the throes of partisan polarization. On the Democratic side and the Republican side, they're way to the left and they're way to the right, and most Californians aren't there. So if Californians want a more sensible, pragmatic legislature, they've got to start electing people like that to office.
All right, Dan, thank you. Dan Weintraub, columnist at the Sacramento Bee and author of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Party of One. Always a pleasure. Hope you come back again. This is 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, celebrating its 40th anniversary in a joyful concert gala Saturday, September 27th at Pasadena's Ambassador Auditorium. Honor the past and rejoice in the present as Jeffrey Gahane performs Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 with LACO's legendary founding music director, Sir Neville Mariner. Tickets at laco.org or at 213-622-7001. The Service Employees International Union is accusing the head of its largest California local of misappropriating hundreds of thousands of dollars in a corporation scheme involving payments to companies run by his wife and mother-in-law. Tyrone Freeman is president of the LA-based United Long-Term Care Workers, which represents 160,000 low-wage caregivers. A union official claims he's been removed from the payroll and faces formal dismissal pending an internal hearing. It's easy now to tip off the LA Police Department about crimes with a text message. To use the text-to-tip system, a cell phone user sends a text message to the numbers on the keypad that spell the word crimes. Police Captain Joel Justice says the sender then begins the message with the letters LAPD.
The tipster will immediately receive a message back stating that if this is an emergency, to call 911. along with an alias. That alias allows us to communicate with the tipster to get additional information should they choose to do so.
The alias also allows the tipster to remain anonymous. The LAPD is using a similar system to handle tips via email. Well, the forecast calls for more hot weather right into the middle of next week. Look for temps in the 70s at the coast to the 90s in the inland valleys. In Bell, the 710 north before Florence has a crash in the fast lane, and it's going to be slow from Firestone Boulevard. It's 2:21.
I'm Pat Morrison. Yes, there are politics even in Hollywood, and I'm not talking just about Chuck Norris supporting John McCain or Sean Penn supporting Barack Obama. The Screen Actors Guild has its share of politics, too. The Screen Actors Guild contract with the producers expired at the end of June. It has been battling for contract terms on that front for a while, but it also now has an election coming up. About a third of its national board seats are up for grabs, and there are challengers who could change the way that the Screen Actors Guild does business. We'll talk about the election, the results of which should be revealed tonight. Anne Marie Johnson is an actor and a member of the National Board for SAG. She's known for playing Althea Tibbs on the NBC and CBS television series In the Heat of the Night, and she joins us to talk about membership first and what it represents. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be with you again, Pat. It's always a pleasure.
So tell us about membership first and the present configuration of the board and why you think it should stay doing what it's doing.
Well, Membership First has been, quote-unquote, a political party within the Screen Actors Guild since 2003. In 2005, we gained a majority of the National Board and a full majority of the Hollywood Divisional Board, and we've had a slight majority since then, and we've done great deeds for our union and for our membership. And this year, as we have in other years, but this year we are being challenged by an opposing slate.
And how have you dealt with this slate, and what does the slate want that you don't think the Screen Actors Guild should be embracing?
Well, although they're not very clear with their plan, we can only assume from some of their literature that what the other slate really is, pardon me, intent in achieving is merger with AFTRA and qualified voting within the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. So those are two things that Membership First is adamantly against. And we have other goals and other plans, but those are the two significant issues that separate us.
What is the issue that that Membership First and the board takes with its partnering with AFTRA?
Well, Membership First, and I have to tell you, Membership First represents a certain amount of members within the Screen Actors Guild. We're not the official voice of the Screen Actors Guild, but Membership First believes that all actors need to be under one roof, but that roof needs to be the Screen Actors Guild and not a merger with AFTRA. There have been 16 failed merger attempts in regard to merging with our sister union. The membership has spoken each and every time, and we just feel it would be advantageous for actors to be represented by one union, and that's the Screen Actors Guild.
Also joining me is Googie Gress, a candidate for the Hollywood Division Board of SAG, where there are 22 seats up for election. He's been a member of the Screen Actors Guild for 27 years, also a member of AFTRA. You can see him in the upcoming Frost Nixon film, and he's just not that into you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. Unlike Anne-Marie, this is my first time, so I hope you two ladies will be gentle.
Well, tell us about Unite for Strength, what it stands for, and what it would like to do to change the Screen Actors Guild.
Well, Unite for Strength is a group that I think of as mostly being spearheaded by a guy named Ned Vaughn, who's a longtime friend of mine. He and I were in Apollo 13 together many years ago, and we've remained friends ever since. Ned asked me to join the group and at the time said there was really only one litmus test for joining, and that was that I be in favor of merger, and I am very much in favor of merger. I believe that there should indeed be just one union that represents actors. I believe, too, that it should be the Screen Actors Guild. I feel, however, that the way in which we go about doing that requires that we merge with AFTRA, and in my opinion, Equity and other members of the 4As as well, so that all actors come under one umbrella, if you will, and that will be the way in which we will be the strongest and the most united and be able to get that which we most need, and that is a way to make a living, especially in these very rapidly changing times.
What about that, Ms. Johnson, given the fact that there are so many different media now for actors to appear in? Some of them have union representation, some of them not. Why not the bigger umbrella that Mr. Gress was talking about?
Well, there's no problem with a bigger umbrella, but I, as an actor and a successful actor for the past 25 years, have nothing in common with a broadcaster or a recording artist. I am an actor, pure and simple, and the Screen Actors Guild, the goal in regard to membership first goal, is to represent purely actors, which include stunt performers, stunt pilots, puppeteers, singers, dancers, on-camera actors, voice-over artists. We are a unique breed, and we are actors, and we want to be seen as such. And we believe that merging with another union that has a lot of financial concerns, that has had a habit for the past, since 2006, of undercutting contracts just to gain jurisdiction, is not the appropriate party to be in bed with.
Mr. Gress, is it apples and oranges then to have actors and performers of every stripe in the same union with broadcasters, for example?
Well, I have a couple of different thoughts about that. My first thought is this. There is one unifying thing, and that is the fact that so many of these people who are delivering whatever it is, albeit the news or the truth by way of telling performances and stories and fictional movies and television, all come to the public through a medium, television, or through their computer that does unify them. So there is a kind of argument as to why we all can be unified, because those that are presenting us are unified. That's one argument that I would have in favor of this unification.
With all due respect, I have absolutely no concern or even understanding of what a broadcaster's life is like on a daily basis, nor would I want to be involved in any of the negotiations that go on in regard to the broadcaster's life as a professional, nor should he or she have anything to say about the life of an on-camera actor who deals with auditions every day, headshots, class. Our lives are, as an actor, 24/7. They don't end when we punch out the clock. We are artists, and there's a philosophical difference between actors and non-actors.
Googie Grass?
Well, my response to that would be, again, twofold. She didn't let me get to the second half of my response before, but I think it addresses part of her concern immediately, and that is, look, when corporations merge, quite often what happens out of those mergers is that certain parts of their businesses are spun off. And indeed, perhaps that could be what would happen here, that the union that the Screen Actors Guild became, that represented all actors, would then essentially spin off the part that was broadcasters. I don't know. I'm not in a boardroom. I'm further not in a meeting room between the entities that would become involved should there be a merger. And what I truly believe is that if the will to have a merger exists, that people will find a way to create the merger, up to and including whatever financial concerns there would be. There's ways of mediating all of that stuff. It's about starting with a will to do the job. Anne Marie was talking previously about how there have been 16 attempts that have failed previously. They have indeed. It doesn't mean that a 17th won't, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to do it.
All right. I'd like to hear, hang on one moment, please. I'd like to hear from you out there listening, if you're a member of the Screen Actors Guild, if you voted in this, your thoughts about what's at stake in this election and the arguments you've been hearing from Anne Marie Johnson and Googie Gress. Give us a call here at 866-893-KPCC. You can also share your ideas and your questions on the blog, the Pat Morrison blog. You'll find it at kpcc.org, or pick up the phone. Give us a call. Hands-free, be safe at 866-893-KPCC. Ms. Johnson,
yes.
What is the relationship between the National Board and the Hollywood Board? There are 11 seats on the National Board and 22 on the Hollywood Board at stake. What's the difference between those positions and what they do?
Well, the National Board is made up of national board members. It's based on the amount of votes that one generates. And then the divisional boards are made up of alternates. They sit on the division board as a full member, and they also sit on the national board as an alternate if needed.
Is there a philosophical split between the National and the Hollywood Board on this issue in particular about AFTRA?
No, none whatsoever. We Membership First makes up the full majority of the Hollywood Division Board, except for one or two seats, and we hold a majority in the National Board. And I just want to make something very clear about merger, although that's not the only issue that's on the that's on the table right now. Those of us in Membership First, and those of us who agree, those members who agree with Membership First, are very uncomfortable with the idea of merging with a union that had absolutely no problem undercutting actors, because when you merge, the producers that we're going to have to negotiate with certainly won't allow us to try to get the highest qualities in our contracts that we have now. They'll find some way to find middle ground, which reduces the wages and working conditions of Screen Actors Guild members. So another reason why we're adamantly against merger with AFTRA. And secondly, I'd like Googie to address the issue of qualified voting, which is actually how Unite for Strength was created from working actors' voices. That's how Unite for Strength was created back in February. I'd like to know his stance on qualified voting. And did he sign the qualified voting petition?
Mr. Gress, define the qualified voting issue for us and then tell us what your position is on it.
Well, qualified voting, as I understand it, was a proposal started by Ned Vaughan, as far as I know, and a few others, in which what they wanted to do is create a bar. And that bar, by the way, initially was nothing more than $1,000 in earnings over a previous year. By doing so, they felt that they would allow actors who they looked at, and whom I must say I look at as well, as what they call stakeholders, as being allowed to vote on contracts.
How do you explain?
Hang on, Ms. Johnson.
A lot of other unions, including Actors Equity, including the WGA, including the DGA, have some form of qualified voting, meaning that people need to have worked under existing contracts. It's not that difficult a requirement to meet. And in my mind, what it really does, Pat, is it affords those who are trying to get in, those who are going to make it as actors, the promise that when they get there, there will be those amongst them who, like them, share their direct concerns about how best to make a living.
All right, well, James, hang on, both of you. Hang on, both of you. We have James calling from Hancock Park, and he has a concern about how each of you may be qualified to address his problem. James, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I've been a Screen Actors Guild member for about 30 years now, and I'm a working class actor. Between the two parties, that has definitely been extremely detrimental to me as a working actor. I think one of the problems is qualified voting, I think, does make sense in the sense that, you know, we merged with the extras, and the extras really didn't address a lot. The extras really didn't have to deal with a lot of the contracts that most, you know, guest stars or even co-stars on shows did, yet we merged with them and some of their issues needed to be addressed. The same thing holds true for, you know, for some of these working, I'm just frustrated right now because I feel that, like, we're at a time where there's been more merging between these corporations, and we're not bonding together in terms of getting together and merging AFTRA and SAG, which I think is one of the most important things we can do, because the buyers or the producers or the networks now have figured out a way to undercut these contracts by doing an AFTRA pilot as opposed to a SAG pilot, which means we work much longer and get less money.
All right, James, thank you. James, let me put the question to Anne-Marie Johnson, because his point is that that there are a lot of shared concerns, that certain actors may have had less in common with the extras or the stunt people.
First of all, they're called background performers. They're not called extras. They haven't been called extras in decades.
Well, you're in the union and I'm not, I leave that to
no,
you.
No, I was actually talking to James, who apparently is in our union, but they're called background performers. These are struggling, beginning actors, many of them. Also, there are actors who have chosen this part of our field to concentrate their talents. It's an admirable position. Kent McCord was an original member of the Screen Extras Guild. It's a very, very difficult job, but they're still actors nonetheless, whether they speak or not.
All right, on the larger point of the fact that the more unions there are, the more easily James thinks that they can be undercut by
producers. Well, no, the only reason why we're having an undercutting concern, not because of the producers, is because AFTRA is offering contracts that have lesser terms and conditions. So, of course, the producers are going to go for the cheaper contracts, but they wouldn't have that opportunity if AFTRA didn't provide that opportunity.
All right, and
one way
Googie
to preclude
Gress?
AFTRA from having that opportunity is by merging with them and creating one bigger, stronger, more unified union that would not allow that to happen.
So is that why AFRA offers...
Hang on, Ms. Johnson.
You were talking a minute ago about the fact that this bigger, more unified entity that I'm describing would indeed be more easily undermined. How do you see it that way? I don't see it that way.
Well, Googie, because I've negotiated 5 contracts within the Screen Actors Guild. I don't know how many contracts you've negotiated for the Screen Actors
Absolutely
Guild.
Absolutely none. That's the point of my group, is that we are a bunch of people.
Across the table from the AMPTP, which are our employers, they don't get 6 to 7 figures salaries a year to see how they can help the actor. Their pure job is to find out how they can undercut the actor. And if we were to merge with our sister union, AFTRA, which already provides producers with lesser terms, do you think merging with that union is going to make the AMPTP say, okay, now you guys are merged, now let's fairly negotiate? What they're going to say is, see, listen, AFTRA lived with these terms that are less than Screen Actors Guild, so we're going to lessen these and certainly not bring it up. This is not going to help us bring up the terms of our wages and working conditions.
All right. Thank you both. We're going to be taking this up after we find out the results of the election tonight. This will be subject that, obviously, from the calls, it's engaged a lot of people. It's something we do want to take up again. My thanks to Anne-Marie Johnson, an actor and a member of the National Board of the Screen Actors Guild. Googie Gress is with Unite for Strength, running for the Hollywood Division board seat on the Screen Actors Guild. Thank you both very much, and I hope we'll have you back soon. Alex Ben Block is a senior columnist for Hollywood Today. He's on the web at hollywoodtoday.net. Alex, obviously there are high feelings running through this election. We've got numbers of calls of people who want to weigh in on this. What exactly is at stake?
Well, there's a great deal at stake, but the merger issue is, I have to say, I compare it to, Nero fiddling while Rome burns. There's not going to be any merger between AFTRA and SAG anytime soon, and the elephant in the room is that there's no contract, and that's what the focus needs to be on. The question is, how is this election going to affect the actual negotiations with the AMPTP over the contract that's been expired since June? And I don't really hear much debate about that. And I think that's the big mystery. So let's assume for a moment that the postcards that they sent out and came back were 87% favorable for what Membership First is proposing and for the group that's leading the union. So that means to me there's a good chance that they're going to do okay in this election that will be announced later tonight. So where does that leave us? It still leaves us without a contract. It's still unlikely that they'll call for a strike vote, although that's a possibility, but they would need 75% approval of their members, and very few people think they can get that. And so they continue with no contract. And meanwhile, AFTRA does have a contract, and on cable they can undercut them. They're actually now organizing prime time shows with their new contract, which is pretty much the same as the old SAG contract with some additions. And so the Screen Actors Guild leaves themselves very vulnerable as a union that can't make a deal, as a union that's being undercut or attacked by a sister actors union that used to be their friend. And I think they're in very bad shape, and I don't hear that being discussed.
And very quickly, what do you think is going to happen when the votes are counted tonight?
Well, I think probably that the Membership First group will continue to rule both the National Board and the Hollywood Board, which, it's the New York board that's split with them, and it's some of the other boards outside of L.A. that are against them. But it looks like they're going to maintain control. And so I have to assume that they're going to continue the posture that they have to do the deal the way they see it. And even with deteriorating economic conditions,
all right,
it's a problem.
Alex, thanks very much. Alex Ben Block, senior columnist for Hollywood Today at hollywoodtoday.net. The results of the Screen Actors Guild vote revealed tonight.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by L.A. Opera, presenting Puccini's Madama Butterfly, the legendary love story. An innocent young Japanese bride devotes herself unconditionally to her American husband, who in the end repays her loyalty with cruel betrayal. James Conlon conducts this Robert Wilson production, L.A. Opera's Madama Butterfly, at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion through October 18th. Tickets at 888-OPERA-LA or laopera.com. Some education and health care groups are urging state lawmakers to come up with a better budget. Lawmakers approved a spending plan this week, but as you know, Governor Schwarzenegger says he'll veto it, and that's probably tomorrow. Mike Harold is with the Western Center on Law and Poverty. He says lawmakers should not override that veto.
We're taking the cost of living adjustments for blind, aged, and disabled persons who have no other way to earn money. We're taking money from poor families who depend upon the CalWORKs welfare program. That's who's getting hurt in this budget.
Governor Schwarzenegger says the budget approved by the state legislature early Tuesday morning punishes taxpayers. He also said the budget made it too easy for lawmakers to tap into the state's rainy day fund. The LA Times reports lawmakers offered to strengthen the restrictions on the rainy day fund. It's unclear whether that will change the governor's veto plans. The governor meets with legislative leaders today. Teenage parents have a tough row to hoe, so do the parents of teenage parents. Ask Amy and listeners' calls, too, talking about parenting teen parents tonight on Talk of the Nation at 9 o'clock here on 89.3 KPCC. Taking a look at traffic in Santa Fe Springs, the 5 North, very slow from Valley View to Florence, where there was an earlier crash. And in downtown L.A., the 10 East is slow from Arlington to the 110. It's 2:41.
I'm Pat Morrison. 450 years ago, Spanish explorers called Los Angeles the Bay of Smokes, and in the centuries since then, it has lived up to its reputation as Smogtown. That's the title of a new book by Chip Jacobs and William Kelly, Smogtown, the Lung-Burning History of Pollution in Los Angeles. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here. This
is a subject that obviously we can't avoid, but there have been lots of technical studies, there have been lots of scientific studies, but this is really the cultural history of smog.
It is, in all its thick, coughing, you know, glory.
We tend to think of smog as something from the 1970s, when we finally seemed to get some real instruments of control in place, but this goes back a long time. Okay, maybe not as far back as Cabrillo and the Spaniards, but it's a problem.
It has been. It was even showing up in turn-of-the-century Los Angeles when they wanted to write it off as just a periodic industrial smoke, and people thought, you know, the winds will blow it away. But it kept coming back and back, and then when it came in the war, it didn't leave.
There was some insouciance about smog. We were talking about this earlier. I have a small collection of smog memorabilia. People sold smog in a can, the same air the Hollywood stars breathe, a smog crying towel. Bill Kelly, why did we have this very almost defensive attitude? Like, yeah, it's our smog, and we're going to make some money out of it.
Well, I think that's part of the lesson of the war on smog, is that it's been about making money, you know, in many respects. And unless you could make money at it, you couldn't do much about it. When you look at it from a policy perspective, that's why the war on smog in Los Angeles has focused on technology, you know, things that you could build and sell and make money off of, better widgets to cut smog.
There was, just to begin reading from your book, the resistance to regulation, Chip Jacobs, was just profound, because anything that got in the way of Los Angeles growing, increasing, becoming more prosperous was simply a no-go.
Absolutely. L.A. was on this massive roll before and after World War II, where they allowed anybody with a permit and something to build to come on in, and they gave them some money and a pat on the back. All of a sudden, 10 years downstream, we had the LA Chamber of Commerce saying, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. And so we had a massive reversal of the mindset of Los Angeles, not just the production of LA, but LA was the ultimate business frontier. And now they were saying, you're going to have to pay, you know, if you want to be here.
How bad was the smog early on? I mean, we hear about London blackout fogs, and we think smog now, it's like, oh, God, it's a little brown rim around the edge of the basin. But what was smog like at its worst?
Well, I mean, you couldn't see down the block, and it was not moisture in the air. It was all pollution. And it is unknown how many people have died, you know, as a result of breathing smog, you know, over the past 60, 70 years. But I can assure you that if you believe the studies that the doctors have done, it's far more than have been killed in traffic accidents or, you know, in gang violence, that sort of thing. And at the time, it was seen largely as an aesthetic nuisance when it first burst on the scene in the 40s. There was denial that it really was a health problem, and people saw it as something that was inconvenient and you know, put ring around the collar and made the eyes water, but that was about it. And no one really wanted to admit or thought at first that it would kill people. That came later in the 1950s. Doctors started to suspect, just like cigarettes, that air pollution was a killer.
Now, in 1903, you describe a daytime haze that forced downtown streetlights on, and citizens mistook it for an unanticipated solar eclipse. So this was something that was really part of our heritage, at least the heritage of our lungs, from early on. Where was smog in 1903 coming from, since there were almost no automobiles?
It was coming from the limited number of factories we had, but the thing that doesn't ever leave Los Angeles, whether we had cars or buggies, and it's a temperature inversion. It's this layer of hot air that can lie over the region like a blanket on certain days. And so no matter what you emit, 10 pounds, 1,000 pounds, it's going to stay. It doesn't disperse into the air. So it doesn't take a lot to make a smoggy condition. And so what they were seeing was a foreshadowing.
So in 1903, we had what? We had people burning trash. We had what else contributed to smog?
We had very messy factories that didn't have carbon catchers and filters and other things. It wasn't Los Angeles as we know it by any means today, but there was enough fumes and dust and gas going to the air combined with this blanket temperature inversion, which is just part of what makes us great, the weather lovely, but it also was going to be what was going to really nail us when there was thousands of factories and millions of cars.
In reading your book, Smogtown, it occurred to me that the real reason that we have TV weatherman is not for the weather, which is pretty consistent, but it's for the report about the air quality and all that. And it did start to figure into weather reports.
Absolutely. Yeah. It got to be the most valuable part because how many times can you say it's going to be 72 degrees and clear? So smog gave the Dallas rains of 20 years ago something, you know, very important to tell people, like don't go outside.
Now, of course, this period from 1903 up until the Second World War, Los Angeles was growing by leaps and bounds. If the government knew about smog and the problems, why did it not anticipate this and say, look, we're getting big, we want to get big, but we don't want to get big and brown?
Well, I don't think that the government was thinking about it in terms of it being a public health problem at that point, and I don't think that the sources of air pollution, you know, the amount of stuff going into the air was so great that it was a constant factor in the area. It was only when we had these severe weather conditions. But as industrialization grew in the 1940s with the war effort and people moved here and the automotive age started, that overwhelmed the air all of a sudden, and it became an omnipresent factor. The only time it wasn't smoggy was when it was raining, you know, virtually.
Or when everybody stayed home and nobody was driving.
Right.
Who were the characters in this story of smog? Who were the heroes and the villains?
To me, there's two sets of heroes. One's the obvious scientists who went against the establishment view that cars, which are Los Angeles, could be the source of our problems. Just down the street from where we are at Caltech, there was this little Dutch biochemist who was going to win a Nobel Prize probably in hormone research, and he just got suckered into smog research and made it his life's mission to prove man caused this. It's chemical reactions, and the sunlight accelerates it. The other big heroes to me are the doctors. And I'm not talking, you know, doctors that are on some famous panel or with a radio show. I'm talking about individual doctors who saw patients in their office and have the guts, actually career-changing guts to say, you know, there's something wrong here. There's something very widespread, and we're seeing a whole class of people that seem to be getting sick from going outside.
What were these doctors told? Were they suppressed? Were they punished?
A lot of them were told not to make smog a cause of death, a cause of injury, a reason to tell a patient, you know, maybe you'd be better off if you lived in Lake Elsinore. But eventually some doctors, including some doctors born out of state, said, you know, this is my responsibility. And a massive political crisis was set off when a doctor wrote smog as cause of death in the 60s. And the LA Board of Supervisors didn't want to accept it. The county coroner didn't want to accept it. But this doctor said, no, this is my duty.
And he put it on the death certificate.
He did. And I don't think smog and epidemiology have been the same since.
And it's ironic because this is the place where tubercular patients came to recover, to breathe and you know, recover their pneumonic health.
Well, that's right, because of the dry air and sunshine and all the rest. But the inexorable march of suburbanization created a clash politically in the area, too, that unfolded particularly in the late 1960s and 1970s. When you had Los Angeles, where most of the people lived and most of the industry was located, and then you had these surrounding counties to the east where the smog was blowing. And so politicians out in that area fought for years to get representation, to have control over the sources of air pollution. They had no say over it for many years. And that was a major fight. So you have both heroes and villains there. Eventually, they overwhelmed Los Angeles County and the legislature and were able to form the South Coast Air District, which is a multi-county area. So they suddenly had representation and power over the sources of pollution.
So who were the villains? We heard about the doctors being heroic, about the Caltech guy being heroic. But who are the villains who said, this isn't really a problem, we don't need to impose any regulations or any controls?
I think the easy villains would be to say a refinery or a power plant. But that's not really fair to them. I think the real villain was ignorance. And a Los Angeles population that was so impatient and maybe selfish to have blue air every second of the day, they couldn't take it, and they demanded lightning answers from a government that didn't have any. And we saw 10 years of chaos with people saying it's sulfur in the air causing it. No, it's ozone. No, it's something else. And 10 years of guessing and speculation, I think, created a tremendous legacy of distrust and confusion. So to answer your question, I just think we couldn't figure out what it was. And if there was an early villain, if I had to put one, I'd have to say it's probably the automakers. Because I think very early on, after they promised to get to the source of why their products were producing smog, they still hadn't done anything. And it was because of this market they had, and they didn't want to lose a golden goose. So it would be the car makers.
Well, and later, I think the land developers who paved this area from here, you know, halfway to Las Vegas and continue to do so today. And now this is a primary struggle when it comes to global warming. Sprawl, you know, is the producer of greenhouse gases in the absence of any auto that doesn't produce them. And so there was a struggle that occurred over that early on when the government was getting organized on smog. They wanted land use control. It came close, but never happened.
Now, we forget how bad this was. It was so bad. It sounds like Johnny Carson. It was so bad. How bad was it that they couldn't film movies sometimes because the smog was so pronounced? And you didn't have smog in a Western. You just had to wait until you could film it. And you have Hedda Hopper writing about Bing Crosby's red eyes, you know, from being out in the smog. So as much as industry had an advantage to not having any regulations, at the same time, industry suffered as well as did Angelenos.
Yes, they did. And business people didn't, you know, they had families. They didn't want to send them out into a hydrocarbon atmosphere. And
you don't want to pick up Collier's and read Threat of Disaster from Smog Hanging Over Los Angeles, but you did.
You did. The people that I think were sent to early graves were the LA Chamber of Commerce people, the boosters, those that were used to pumping out these beautiful postcard, you know, come hither to Los Angeleses. And all of a sudden, they're fighting the New York Times, Harvard, elite institutions up and down the seaboard saying, see, this is Los Angeles. It's getting its comeuppance for growing so fast and being so vain and ambitious. They deserve what they're getting. And, it didn't sit well in the mayor's office, and it didn't sit well at the boosters.
Was there a tipping point for this? You cite July 26, 1943, the smog beast wafted into downtown Los Angeles. Traffic cops seemed to disappear in the mysterious haze. Were Japanese saboteurs responsible? Was that a turning point when people actually realized how much it was affecting their lives on a day-to-day basis?
Well, there's no question it was a turning point, and there's no question that politicians took note and became active on the problem at that point. And the county of Los Angeles formed a agency to control air pollution, you know, as an immediate response to that. And it grew and grew from there, primarily because the things they did to begin with didn't make smog go away. it didn't work too well.
But what I think is interesting is that from the time of the attack during World War II to the time that we got most focused on the heart of the issue, which is tailpipes and car engines, took us 17 years to get the state to do something about it. And if you think about the people that died because of that or permanently sidelined because of that, businesses that went out, you know, of business because they couldn't afford. 17 years is a long time to get to the heart of the matter.
And the fact that it was so damaging to agriculture. California, L.A. County had been the single biggest agricultural county in the United States into the 1950s, and you'd tell stories of all the plants that are dying under this. The fact that that we still had backyard incinerators. Sounds like I'm standing next to one right now.
That's right.
It's phenomenal that it took as long as it did.
Well, that's right. It took a long time. And then even finally when the state formed the California Air Resources Board under Ronald Reagan, it took a long time, even when it had the power to force the automakers to clean up the auto, for them actually to do that. There was a reticence on the part of Governor Reagan to force the auto companies to install controls like catalytic converters for fear it would cost too much. There was a reticence to require people to get their cars smog checked because it would interfere with personal liberty, and that battle took a long time.
And the personal liberty to burn trash in the backyard, too. So, Chip Jacobs, we take for granted that we now have some of these regulations and controls.
Yes, we do. We don't realize, you know, our forefathers fought over them basically in the Second Battle of Los Angeles. There was a point in the 50s when it was so bad there were people talking, usually behind closed doors, about whether to evacuate the most smoggy and chronic areas just because it didn't seem to be salvageable. Nobody knew how to really make it go away.
People had smog suits. People did treat it as if it were kind of a wartime thing. Do you have a favorite smog story?
Do I have a favorite smog story? My favorite story is when it was getting so bad in the 50s and a very optimistic people, transplanted population, was really getting cynical. That's why I think you saw smog in the can. It was commercialism, and it was also just giving up hope. My favorite is this hen that laid an egg, and when the farmer came to look at this hen, and it was born in an L.A. County area, it was green. And I'm not talking light green. It was dark green. And the only answer was, look what smog did to this baby.
Think
about being a mother hen there.
So many souvenirs of smog, but most of the souvenirs in the lungs of people who lived in Southern California. The story of the fight to defeat smog told in Smogtown, the lung-burning history of pollution in Los Angeles. Chip Jacobs and William Kelly are the authors, and they have joined me here. Thank you, gentlemen, both very much. I feel like going outside and taking some deep breaths.
Thank you. I'm going to do that right now.
Breathe well.
The story of smog, the story of Los Angeles, how it became insouciant, cynical, and finally serious about fighting the battle of smog, the book again, Smogtown. Another book tomorrow, Christopher Buckley is the author of Supreme Courtship. He'll be here to talk about that comic novel that may veer a little close to the truth when it comes to American politics and the justice system. Christopher Buckley will be here tomorrow. I'm Pat Morrison. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of this program, you can always subscribe to the podcast. You'll find it at kpcc.org.